Folks, welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour on corporate free community radio station WRFU Radio Free Urbana, broadcasting from downtown Urbana, Illinois at 104.5 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WRFU.net. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent the views of WRFU, the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, or the Urbana Socialist Forum. WRFU, Radio Free Urbana, community radio by and for the people. And so we're going to have an interesting program today. Of course, we're going to be talking about the recent U.S. Presidential elections. We're going to be having a guest come in here shortly from the U of I Student Greens. We're going to be having a caller call in from Denver, Colorado, who basically is out at the North Dakota pipeline resistance camp for a couple days. And then at 12:20, we're going to be having our West Coast correspondent John Ryman call in from Oakland, California, to talk about a huge anti-Trump rally in Oakland Wednesday night that had over 7,000 people there. So anyway, I guess first we'll do some underwriting announcements with Gus.
This hour of programming is brought to you by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of community and union groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice hosts regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, go to www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. The Graduate Employees Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but they also give solidarity and support to unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is also supported by Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. This hour of programming is supported part by AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of over 7,000 workers in Champaign County and over 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support the World Labor Hour and the community radio in East Central Illinois. The Campus Faculty Association at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign advocates for academic freedom, shared governance, and a strong faculty voice on campus. The CFA is proud to support community radio and the World Labor Hour in support of strong unions. You can learn more about the CFA by visiting CFAIllinois.org. The Illinois Single Payer Coalition is proud to sponsor the World Labor Hour on WRFU-FM. The Illinois Single Payer Coalition believes that health care is a human right and is dedicated to expanded and improved Medicare for all. For more information, go to IllinoisSinglePayer.org.
Okay, thank you, Gus. So, all right, you know, just a little, some quick news. I guess we could start with you, Gus, as far as some news headlines, both about and maybe other items other than the U.S. presidential election.
Well, I guess I got some data that we're going to break down later on in the show in regards to the constituencies, electoral, et cetera. But I think one of the biggest things that we have to recognize, and that a good thing for the show, is understanding what this means moving forward in terms of how we resist, how we build, how we organize. You know, one of the things that has been happening across the country at this point is that, you know, this white nationalism, this fervent, explicit white nationalism, has reared its heads on college campuses, in public school rooms. There have been numerous KKK rallies, particularly those that know about Stone Mountain in Georgia. A couple of black students are being beaten. Swastikas are being spray painted on buildings everywhere. They even had a middle school rally of white children screaming white power through hallways.
Where was that at?
I will find it during this segment, but that was just one of the stories.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Wednesday morning there was pictures of many places around the country. There were swastikas drawn spray painted with Trump, really crude graffiti. I'd read about several incidences like you were talking about, and grade school kids.
Yeah, these are grade
high school kids.
Elementary school and middle school kids.
You know, it's this alt-right thing. It's,
well, we've had these incidences on the University of Illinois campuses as well, and other college campuses in Pennsylvania. There's actually they found a Facebook group with a list of black people at Penn State that were put on this lynching list.
Oh wow!
And this was a Trump supported group.
The black. There was one university. I'd never heard of it. It had a kind of an odd name. I think it started with a C. And there was a couple of incidents there. One thing was a black baby doll with a noose around it.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the other one. Right.
I'll find it.
Now, I think that was one maybe where they had the swastika and Trump's on their field house.
Yeah.
Somebody painted it on their field house.
But for that to say is that, you know, there's been a lot of talk from the corporate media about this, about the class element of why Trump won. And we'll talk about that in regards to the numbers. But we have to understand that this thing is the biggest aspect of how he won was through his discourse of white nationalism. I'm going to bring the country back to the white supremacists. I'm going to bring it back to the white nationalists.
The 1950s.
Retake the country. Exactly, the 1950s. I'm going to take it back to when Trump and his people argued that America was great, when people knew their place, when there was a social class structure where explicit white nationalism delineated who could do what and can't do when. And he preached to the crowd of people who believe that that social delineation had been broken over the past few decades. You know, so and one of the things that we're going to talk about is that for the first time in decades, when he's inaugurated, white nationalists will control all three branches of the federal government.
Yeah. You know something? It's not so much Trump as it is Paul Ryan. Mm-hmm. That could be a really big worry about things.
Exactly.
Even though he doesn't seem I don't know. He doesn't seem to ever really kind of beat any kind of a drum about anything on racial issues, but all of his policies are bad.
Yeah, exactly.
For lower income people.
Ultra conservative. And we're talking about the complete usurpation of resources from working class and poor people. We were talking about these past couple of years of looking at people falling out of the working class into the sub working class and then being declassed into the lumpen proletariat.
Mm-hmm.
We need to understand that this thing is going to swell even worse now, because if you look at Trump's 100-day plan,
oh man,
I mean, it is some really nasty stuff that we haven't seen since the likes of Reagan. But again, one of the things that we have to
but it's all stuff that the Republicans really want.
Yeah, these are
he's
things
just
they all
explicit,
want.
More explicit about things and kind of more simplified too.
But the thing is that he's going to actually not only control the federal government, but he has these acolyte groups now. These white nationalist groups that are going to do his bidding. Yeah. We're talking about increased surveillance and police. We're talking about vigilante groups.
Yeah, I'm getting real worried about that.
Oh,
yeah.
Exactly. I mean, this thing is getting really serious now, and there's been a lot of downplaying of how serious this is going to be in relation to working class and poor people, black and brown people.
Oh,
but
yeah.
We need to understand that we are in survival crisis mode now. And some of the people I know argue that he's not going to ease in the first 100 days, that he's going to hit the ground running and tell people, hey, it's free for all time. We got to get this country back on track now. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to understand. This is an emergency situation for people in this country.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about this later in the show too, but let's understand that Hillary Clinton was not our savior.
Of course not.
In fact, she and the corporate Democrats are partly to blame for the rise of Trump and Trumpism and all this. So we're going to talk about, there's plenty of blame to go around, and we're definitely going to break this down.
Oh, yeah, I got some
data. Yeah, it doesn't freak me out that Hillary Clinton isn't president. Now, it doesn't bother me that much that Donald Trump is president as much as it bothers me that it's all three branches of the government.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
You know, which did occur for a while, 2003 to 2006. There's been a mistaken meme get out on the internet that the last time this happened was in 1928.
Yeah, but the thing that we have to recognize is that this will be the first time that you would have an ideological block in the federal government of white nationalism, because Trump is going to pick groups that he's going to pick people that are not only ultra conservatives, but also people who are going to believe in this division and this social hierarchy that has to be recreated. This is the first time this has happened in a long time.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Like, his Supreme Court judge is not going to just be a super conservative. They're going to have an ideology about how they feel about black and brown people in this country. And that's why it's going to be the first time that that type of ideology of white nationalism is going to be controlling the entire federal government.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of things are going to get cut off. People need to be getting jobs now, looking for jobs, because he's gonna do a lot, change a lot.
So the whole thing really is that we, as people trying to organize and build together, we have a two-front war we're fighting. We're going to be fighting the federal government, which is something that we haven't had to really focus as much on in terms of they've been neglectful and indifferent over the past few years as neoliberals. Because, you know, that's what they do. You know, they're indifferent. But we also have to fight the ground war now as this white nationalism, this state sponsored and vigilante violence and usurpation of resources is going to come down on working class and poor people. So it's a two front war that is going to be fought now, something that we haven't had to deal with seriously for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really worried about Medicaid. You know, SNAP program. Everything I see is like numbers like over the next 10 years, it's usually something like $120 billion, $150 billion, you know, trimming back on various programs like that.
Mm-hmm.
And these things aren't getting any cheaper
exactly.
to provide. Yeah. You know, medical care is not getting cheaper.
Yeah, I mean, but this is going to be interesting. I mean, I think there's definitely danger here. There's no doubt. But I think we also have some opportunities here, because I think this is definitely waking a lot of people up. And I guess they're going to have to see how a lot of this transpires. But anyway, Angela had a news story here, a local news story that I think is really important that she wanted to share with the listeners.
Yes, this is about Parkland. I'm currently attending Parkland right now, but they're having a meeting on Wednesday the 16th at 7 p.m. in room D. 244, and this is about the budget cuts that are coming up. 20 positions have already been cut
at Parkland.
Yes, teachers are not being looked out for by administration. 80 plus more jobs are getting ready to get cut. They're cutting off vocational programs, agriculture, mechanic, several, you know, programs that are getting cut, and there's no new director for disabilities.
Oh,
yeah, but this is something that we've actually seen coming. I think we talked about on the show a while back that, you know, there's already been rumblings amongst the union members about what's going on at Parkland. And now that we see that these cuts now are officially announced, then this is the point that we're at now. You have austerity measures being implemented at all different labor sectors, particularly at places like education. I mean, we've already talked about, you know, Trump's complete dismissal and wanting to smash the education department into pieces. So you can imagine what's going to happen in terms of teacher protection and working conditions for teachers, not just at the secondary level, but at the collegiate level now. So this is something that couldn't come at a worse time now, where there's not going to be much support. There's not going to be any. And that's the thing that we have to recognize, is that the support that we would normally get, and I'm not talking about like outright support, but there would be something there from the federal government, that's going to be gone now.
Like the Pell Grants.
There's going to be nothing of support. So that's why Dave said this is the perfect opportunity for those teachers at Parkland who are not union members yet, and for other teachers in other areas who are not union members, to actually build their rank and file and start getting ready to do some serious organizing, not mobilization, not just coming to some rallies and just passing stuff out, but actually building relationships that says, I'm going to risk my livelihood for my brother or sister or whatever pronoun you use. And I'm going to support you so that we can win this, because they are going to come down with a hammer on working people.
Oh, yeah, they already are. And one of my teachers there, I'm not mentioning any names, but he said, you know, I guess he just got in full time, but he was part time. But he was like, thank God I got in full time, because he wouldn't be making any money part time. And then you're not in the union, like, you know, Gus said. So, you know, pretty much they're not getting any benefits. They're working their butts off. And they're good teachers. You know, as long as you come be on time, you do your work, they work with you. And they want to, you know, they help us and they want to better the community. But, you know, they're making it hard. They're steady cutting these teachers. They're just not getting anything, and it's only getting worse, as Gus said.
And that's why ideology matters. You know, when you have administrators who do not have of the experience or respect for education, you have a president who believes in running everything like a corporation, and we all know education is the conflict against.
And he loves the undereducated,
exactly.
As he exactly had said.
And that's the point. That's why I'm telling you, we have to prepare for this. Is a new moment. This is something we've never seen before. A lot of people are saying, well, we survived worse. We had Reagan. People don't understand that even during the Reagan times, you could still afford college at some point. You have a president and he's going to pick a cabinet of people and probably get rid of the education department that says that nobody needs education as long as they're able to work for a living. I mean, this is the type of mindset. So you're going to see the complete dismissal of rights for teachers or for any type of resources to build schools or improve schools. I mean, we have to prepare for this.
Well, and also too, they could go in the first day and hit that nuclear option, and there would be no stopping them at all. And the way that they've been acting the last several years, I'm really worried about that.
Yeah,
I mean all that takes is a simple majority.
Yeah, you're right.
It's a rule. It's not a law.
And again, a lot of people are saying, "Oh, he wouldn't do that." We are still the only country in America and in world history that has ever.
Talking about getting rid of the filibuster in the Senate.
But that's part of it too. Yeah, though. I mean they'll do that as well.
You know, I was telling somebody that Trump, soon as he was elected, he probably said, now that I'm in charge, there's actions going to be done. You know, let's get this done right here. Look, he wants things done before they're even done. So,
yeah. But let's understand, too, that if, you know, Hillary Clinton would have won. I mean, she was going to escalate tensions further with Russia and China.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And expand these wars. I mean, so it was a horrible choice we had.
It wasn't meant for her to be president, because if it was, she would have been. And you know what? I said that on that news. Remember I told you I was on the news in Brooklyn's building. The lady was like, who do you vote for? And I said, you know, I don't know who to vote for, but I said that we've been dealing with racism, but then making a choice, you know, Hillary making a choice, we all could be out of here. The wrong choice. Yeah. A lot of people don't agree with that, mm-hmm. but we've been dealing with racism.
So to put this in more of an analytical perspective, what happened that we already see in regards to the first 100 days is the transition team shakeup is very big and people aren't really paying as much attention to it as they should, but they really should. So Trump reorganized his transition team on Friday, naming Vice President-elect Mike Pence to replace Chris Christie as chairman and installing an ultra-right figures as vice chairs along with four members of his own family. The presence of Trump's three adult children, Ivanka, Eric, and Donald Jr., and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as members of the panel planning his new government is really unprecedented and given a quasi-dynastic character of the Trump presidency. I mean, we have to understand what this means. Throughout the campaign, Trump claimed that he would separate his billion-dollar hotel and resort empire from a Trump administration by turning over the business to his children. But instead, he has named his children in his administration. The installation of Pence seems to be an admission that Christie is damaged goods at this point, because we all know what's going on with the bridge scandal and how I still don't know how he escaped prosecution for that, but he may get indicted later on. But you know, his presidential hopes are over for at least another 10 years. But after several of his former top aides were convicted in the George Washington bridge tie-in scandal, in which they, you know, Pence. The thing that we have to understand is what Trump is playing to now, especially with all the anti-Trump protests going on now. Pence is an evangelical leader and one of the biggest groups that voted for Trump. And we'll talk about this when I break down the data later on, is the evangelical crowd. So they're going out tomorrow in service to tell people that this is a godsend. This is, no, seriously, this is, this, the evangelical electorate overwhelmingly supported Trump, regardless of his horrible the child molestation case that's out on him right now, that still has not gone to trial. The sexual assault stuff, all these things that are coming out now. The evangelical crowd still supported him.
Hey, I mentioned earlier before the show too, Gus, and of course we're going to talk about this later on as far as the class, racial, and every other breakdowns. Was that you said he got? I couldn't believe the number of African Americans, the percentage that voted for Trump. What was that? 12?
He got 18%.
18% of African.
87.
Yeah. Well, here's another.
13%.
Would you say? Would you say probably most of them were like religious based, and it was part of the evangelical crowd?
Ministers, particularly in middle class cities, were holding rallies for Trump. They actually invited him to speak at some of the black churches. So that was part of it. And we'll break that down later. But yeah,
now, I got another one here, another group, and this is regards one of your favorite labor leaders, Gus. And this is
Dennis
from
Williams. Dennis Williams.
This is from the Detroit News. Yes, Detroit News, written by somebody named Melissa Burden. And UAW President Dennis Williams said Thursday that the union wants to work with President-elect Donald Trump to renegotiate or kill the North American Free Trade Agreement. The union head, speaking to reporters Thursday in Detroit, said surveys it conducted just before the election showed an estimated 28% or more of its 415,000 or so union members likely voted for Trump. Earlier surveys indicated about 25% plan to vote for Trump. The union plans to poll its membership again now that the election is over. Okay. Williams said the union agrees with Trump that NAFTA needs to be renegotiated or overturned and that the Trans-Pacific Partnership also should be halted. He said he is willing to talk with Trump on his ideas for a 35% tariff on cars built in Mexico and that are imported back to the United States and a tariff with China. Quote, "We're prepared to work with him on a jobs bill and infrastructure bill," Williams said. "We think that's pertinent to the economy and to the future of the United States."
That's how you know Dennis Williams is completely full of garbage.
Yeah.
You're going to attempt to speak to a president that has publicly stated that he is against the minimum wage. One who has actively sought to move jobs to non-union areas.
He has his own products made in overseas, exactly. And the exact same thing he's talking about going against. And I'd like to see this stuff too, but I think it needs to be. I think you need to kind of phase these things in. A 35% tariff right off the bat is, I think, really.
I've always advocated for company specific tariffs as opposed to country, focused tariffs.
But I do think we still, this country, before the income tax, that's what financed it. Mm-hmm. It was tariffs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got an AFL-CIO said that 56% of union members voted for Clinton and 37% for Donald Trump.
Really?
Of those who voted.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But, the thing is, but all these people that I'm on jobs with anyway, they love going to Walmart. They get these tariffs and stuff, all that stuff. Walmart's going to go up.
Oh yeah.
Going to go up before factories are opened here to build TV sets. I'll guarantee you.
No, you're right about that. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a quick music break. You're listening to the World Labor Hour and listener supported community radio station WRFU, and we will be right back.
Unfurled in city streets across the world, and every bell in the city's rung, every freedom song that's yet unsung. We'll find a voice, we'll find a way to fill the air on the 1st of May. And in the storm we'll bend like the willow gill, but together we'll stand the wall against the wind. Along freedom's road, at the barricade or in the jail cell, to struggle hard is to struggle well. The struggle is alive today. We're marching out on the 1st of May, and in the storm we'll bend like the whispers in the migrant field clenched fist.
Okay, we're back. That was Tom Morello. The name of the song was A Wall Against the Wind, which I thought, you know, might be a good one to play today. And I like we were just talking on the break here. I mean, I don't want this all to be doom and gloom. And in that regard, I've got some interesting stuff here as far as what various organizations, individuals, or whatever are kind of doing right now around the country. The first thing, this is from the Green Party, which it says, now that the dust has settled around the presidential election and people like you and me are coming out of the profound shock of a Trump presidency, it's become apparent that the green vote and green issues gained a lot of ground this year. 1.2 million votes for Jill Stein and Ajuma Baraka, which is double the amount that was gotten in 2012. The Green Party has gotten ballot access as a result. And there's all sorts of different things that were actually, that were some silver linings in this cloud, like marijuana legalization in California, Massachusetts, Nevada, as for full recreational and medical marijuana initiatives passed in Florida, North Dakota, and Arkansas. This means there'll be less people put in prison, and I know at least in California, I don't know about the other places, but I know at least in California, anybody that's currently in prison that was there because of marijuana offenses, that they'll be immediately released and their records expunged. Hopefully that's the case in the other states. Every single minimum wage initiative, ballot initiative out there passed. In Alabama, Colorado, and Maine, the minimum wage will increase to $12 an hour here in the next, 3 years. And in Washington State, the minimum wage will increase to $13.50 by 2020. Still not enough. It needs to be 15 or more.
It's 15 is not even close. 15 was okay maybe 5 years ago, with the cost of living skyrocketing and not in correlation with the minimum wage.
Yeah, but I mean, still, I mean, the voters had to go, do a ballot initiative, get that even, but anyway, it's funny because as we talked earlier, there's all these people, 80% of voters in America were repulsed by this election, according to a poll in the New York Times.
But here's the thing, though, that in my research, I've learned is that a lot of these employers are skating around this minimum wage increase by decreasing hours for workers.
Yes.
And that's something I've seen happening a lot since the Fight for 15 campaign started. So you have a lot of employers. I know some people that work at Walmart who have had their hours cut, especially if they start causing trouble or asking about raises, So this is something that I've actually seen happen. And so these employers, this is a legal precedent that employers can do to stop people from making more money than they can live off of. I mean, it's horrible.
That's only going to work for a while, though. I mean, if all of a sudden, which doesn't seem like the next few years, but eventually if there's, all sorts of demand for their products, I mean, they're going to be, short-handed, and they're not going to be able to,
Well, we can get into some Marxist analysis of supply and
right. I know there's overproduction right now.
That's the thing, though. We'll save that for another time.
That's why they're having 2 and 3 jobs. I know people with 3 jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, the Green Party press release goes on. It says, not only did the Democratic National Committee sabotage Bernie Sanders' campaign, they actively worked with corporate media to elevate Donald Trump as a Pied Piper candidate to encourage the most extreme elements of the Republican Party, thinking that it would help Hillary Clinton have a better chance of getting elected. And it's just despicable what they did. And it says, you feel sad about this election of Trump, but ultimately we must pick up, move on, and continue with the really great momentum. This goes on, and the faces need to start organizing, speaking out more, including calling for immediate direct actions against the passage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It looks pretty bleak now, them getting that passed in lame duck session, and already plans to mobilize against it. And basically go on to say they're also co-organizing for Occupy the Inauguration on January 20th and 21st, the anniversary of is knighted, that basically when the General Trump is inaugurated in office, there's going to be a huge turnout in Washington, D.C. And they basically end by saying nothing has changed for us. Nothing has changed in regard to our party building directives. We were going to have to fight either way and resist empire no matter what. And they go on to say more than 1.2 million people stood up for what they knew was right and voted for the Green Party as opposed to the horrible selection of either Trump or Clinton. And they said, our movement's growing. This is the beginning, not the end, and we'll not mourn forever. We'll organize. So, I like where this was going. This is not the only one. As I said, John Reinman's going to be calling in here at 12:20. 2020, and he basically posted something on his Facebook page and said, "Thank you, Donald Trump. You brought tens of thousands of young people out in the streets on the night after the elections to protest against you and what you stand for. We noticed that you've toned it down already, though. Instead of talking about putting Hillary in jail, you're giving her compliments. And we see that you're surrounding yourself with the same Goldman Sachs banksters and speculators that all the other presidents have. Meanwhile, here's what you helped create. Here in Oakland, California, Wednesday night, there's a reported 7,000 demonstrators at a rally in Oakland, California, and overwhelmingly majority were young, and about half of them were women. This from the Industrial Workers of the World Union. It says, "Greens, in the wake of Trump's victory with the rise of the far right, there is a newfound energy among the left. I've seen many individuals who were reluctant in the past to commit to a project express a newfound desire to start organizing. It goes way beyond protests and social media posts. People are generally afraid, and they should be. In addition to the threat of Trump poses to people of color, immigrants, the queer community, and Muslims, Trump also poses a significant threat to workers' rights and their economic security. And to counter this menace, we need a large, organized labor response." So, I mean, this is just, you know, I'm glad to see people are responding this way, you know, as opposed to a lot of other people just that say the sky's falling.
Yeah, Dave, you're speaking of the Green Party, and there's been a lot of course, Jill Stein bashing and spoilerism.
Well,
and she only got like 1% of the vote.
Yeah, 1.2 million.
Okay. And which is, by the way, Eugene Debs got about 1 million votes when he was in prison with a much smaller electorate.
Yes.
But anyway.
So your point?
Yeah. Well, I was reading Counterpunch a lot today.
Uh-huh.
And there's a article here by Jeffrey St. Clair.
Yes.
And he's talking about the percentages and numbers and stuff. Mm-hmm. But what happened is there was like maybe around 2 million less people that voted for Hillary Clinton than voted for Barack Obama in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's what the problem was. It was the same way with Gore. It was not a good candidate. It was a poor campaign. You looked at Clinton's rallies. She would get dozens to maybe hundreds of people, while Sanders and Trump were pulling thousands into tens of thousands.
Yeah, how many turned out here just in Champaign-Urbana, a city of a size of 100,000 when he came to before the election here?
Yeah, but so
thousands. I think it was close to 10,000 people.
Yeah, I mean this is really 2,000 all over again. Yeah,
kind of.
Much.
Yeah, because she won the popular vote too.
Yeah, so half a percentage point,
yeah,
I think.
Nah, but she actually, they say it could go up to 2 million.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see, that's the justification that's being used with the petition for the electors, is that, hey, follow the popular vote.
Yeah.
Well,
here we go. This
job.
Is, I mean, there's a lot, the chickens are coming home to roost in a lot of different ways, and one of this is this messed up, antiquated, anti-democratic electoral college system we have in this country.
It's a small D democratic.
Yes.
It's pretty bad.
They
but,
didn't want a woman to run.
Well, no, let's not go there.
Yeah,
look, you know what?
We can't.
I've had people throw that at me before, too.
No.
And I said, you know what? I voted for Cynthia McKinney, an African-American woman, in 2008. And I voted for, I mean, do you want a woman who's Margaret Thatcher, or do you want a woman who's...
I voted for two women for president.
That doesn't fly, because she won the popular vote.
Yes.
She won it handily by 2 million votes. So we can't throw gender identity politics in this and that, because Hillary, she won the popular vote. So I don't.
And it wasn't because she was a woman a lot of people dislike her. It's because of her past track record as a politician.
Policy, attitude.
She's a record as well.
But Clinton.
Oh, of course he does. Well, he's a comment. But here's the thing: is a lot of people. He never had public office. All Trump had was a reality TV show. You know, Hillary Clinton, I mean, deplorable. I mean, elitist, you know, Wall Street puppet, warmonger. I mean, racist even. She's the one that made, what was that, Gus,
Hillary
back in the
Clinton,
90s? A super predator.
Hillary, I don't even care about that.
Yeah.
That's not even, her super predator mess is not even half as bad as the policies that she allowed to happen to hurt the black working class.
Yes.
When her husband was president and she was part of writing a bunch of bills and doing other stuff. Hillary Clinton is probably the worst Democrat in the history of America. American politics in regards to her policies her beliefs, her ideology, and her campaigns that neglect African American and young people, because that's the reason why she lost. And Dave is right. Trump has past discretions that are in regards to his business practices and his morality. Clinton has actually used policy to hurt hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people in this country and overseas. So that's why people know her as to be a liar, a warmonger, an elitist, a neoliberal. But Trump, on the other hand, and this is important, that's why we have to talk about this, is that he appealed to a group of people that truly felt that white nationalism is the only way to get the country back in the shape it needs to be in. That if we embrace white, if the country embraces white nationalism as the major ideology, it will recreate a social hierarchy that will deal with black and brown people and get the material wealth and the resources back to the majority white masses. That is important to recognize, that race was a major part of this class struggle in this election.
Well, yes. I live like right in the middle of all this stuff. As a matter of fact, my county went 45% for Alan Keyes against Barack Obama for that Senate race.
Mm-hmm.
That's just because he had an R before his name. Nobody, I bet they didn't have any idea that he was black.
Yeah,
and I'm sure they didn't know that he was crazy too. Has he ever lived in Illinois? But these people, they range from, I'm sure a lot of them would swear, just like Trump, that they're not racist at all. The people that I live around, and that they're not woman haters because they probably don't know what misogynist means. But no, they're not stupid people either. Maybe they're business people. Yeah, what was that? There was a study done, I believe, by Pew earlier this year that found that the Trump voter was actually a little bit higher educated and higher income.
Yes, that's the thing that got me too about
the bourgeoisie, the petty bourgeoisie,
just like who supported the Nazis. Every time the corporate media would show a press rally, they would go and find the most working class people to focus in on, to basically say that, oh, it's all these, these poor and working class whites. Not to say there was not a lot of them that voted for Trump, but you're right, I've seen the same polls.
And Bill brought up the best point. I mean, we have to get this across, is that this is not strictly a poor, rural, poor and working white class thing that happened.
Yes.
Bill is exactly right that you had many educated, petty bourgeoisie, middle class people that not only voted for Trump, but actually use voter intimidation and other means in their areas to force people to vote for Trump. It went through classes. It wasn't just this one class that voted for him. That's why we have to understand this, is that there was an emergency call for white nationalism that we've been talking about.
I kind of broke it down as far as the core of the problem of why Trump got elected, and you guys can agree or disagree with this, but my first on the list is the corporate media. All that free attention they gave him during the Republican primaries. I like to tell a story when I took my wife to the doctor right before Christmas. I went to the doctor's office, took my book, all these TVs blaring, and it was like in 20 minutes I sat there, I heard Donald Trump's name mentioned at least 100 times, okay? I heard Bill and Hillary Clinton's name mentioned about 12 times, and they didn't mention Bernie Sanders' name once. In fact, they were referring to the upcoming New Hampshire primary, and they said Hillary Clinton's opponent. They wouldn't even name him by name, okay? And I thought it was Fox, and I got up to look at the television. It was MSNBC. Yeah. The other thing is corporate money in elections. Here we go again. I mean, instead of having a totally publicly financed electoral system to where it's illegal to give campaign contributions to candidates, and where all candidates get equal public television and radio access time, instead we've got, if a candidate wants to run and win, they've got to outspend their opponent on getting on television, getting on radio, getting billboards, and that sort of thing. There's the other problem. The other, voting rights. How many people cannot vote in this country that should be allowed to vote? Gus, I think we talked about this before the show. I mean, people that have, in some states, people with felony convictions can't vote ever in the rest of their life.
Yeah.
Not to mention that, people in prison. Why shouldn't people in prison be allowed to vote? Vermont allows prisoners to vote, but, still. And not to mention voter suppression, like you were saying, voter disenfranchisement. With these scrubbed roles where some states where your name, you have a similar name or the same name to somebody that anybody that has a name like yours that had a felony conviction, they basically sponge your name from the voting rolls, and you got to try to prove it's not you.
Yeah.
Then there's the Democratic Party's neoliberalist policies going back to Bill Clinton, and in particular the last 8 years of Barack Obama.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and last but not least, which I want to go to in more specifics here later in the show, my biggest blame out there is the national union leadership, with the exceptions of the UE, the National Nurses Union, the postal workers, and the communication workers, who did not support Bernie Sanders from the get-go, because if all the unions would have got behind the most pro-labor candidate, working person candidate in I don't know how long, immediately with money and membership going door-to-door and stuff, he could have easily beat Clinton. I think they would have had to resort to massive election fraud and disenfranchisement other than what they did, you know, that was exposed by WikiLeaks. So that's how I break it down as far as the blame to go around. And like I said, I want to get into some more specifics on the national union leadership here a little bit later.
Yeah, that's a great breakdown. I think that.
I wanted to bring something up for a positive action for the future. And remember, it's only a couple of years until congressional elections.
Yes.
All right. I'm not sure how this all lays out. I don't have the numbers. But an organization that's come up just recently that has some interesting ideas is called Brand New Congress. And if you search that on the internet, it's easy to find. They just have basically a fairly progressive agenda, and they want to work. They want to have people in every congressional district, you know, running, or their candidates that are vetted by Brand New Congress.
But you got to get the right candidates, you know. I mean, the perfect case in point is our last gubernatorial election in 2014. A lot of people are still saying, why did Rauner win? Well, look who he is running against. You had the incumbent governor, Pat Quinn, who was basically responsible for the theft of state workers' pensions, and his running mate, Paul Vallis, who was the corporate charter school king, and who also was responsible for making it to where the residents of the city of Chicago cannot vote for their school board. So I mean, this is the thing, is you can't, this is what the lesson I'm hoping a lot of people learn out there. Stop voting for everybody with a D behind their name, because these corporate Democrats, look what they've brought us. This is exactly what they've brought us.
And this is why
in most of Central, you've got to vote for the candidate anyway.
This is my criticism of the recent protests and rallies about, you know, the anti-Trump stuff. I appreciate what people are doing and coming out and voicing their displeasure and, you know, just disgust. Perfect. But the question is, what is the objective of the protests and the rallies? Just to show displeasure? Because you have to take that energy. And again, this is why we have to read more. We have to understand how to build social movements and how to take something as big as this. When you have over 10,000 people around the country who are angry, you got to take that anger and you got to fervent into an objective cause.
Well, that's why I'm suggesting something like this Brand New Congress.
But here's the thing, though, and I think that that's a good idea. But when we have to think about the material conditions that are about to be attacked now, then that needs to be something. I agree. That should be one. It should be a different.
Well, it should be
of
part
four or five
of it.
Things. Yeah.
See, is this finally going to be the time when the activist groups around Champaign? I'm going to specifically say the more white activist groups finally get out in the neighborhoods, because I do think that in the black community that there is more of an activist, you know, kind of a larger base.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we get over here by Scottswood in East Urbana. Mm-hmm. You know, those people there's probably a whole bunch of people there that voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know, because they're poor, they're working at Solo Cup, you know, and they want those factories to come back.
Yeah.
And you know, we need to be out there, you know, talking to them, finding out
good
what
point,
their
Bill.
Problems are. And I mean, I've been harping on this for years and years and years.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but you know what? People have an opinion now, because the stuff is getting real.
Yeah,
and one thing, and
that's
and,
a good point.
That's what I mean.
And that goes in, and that goes into dialectics, that our conditions of oppression create our conditions for resistance, and we have to, and we have to have four or five objective goals that we are going to use as we build a movement. One of them, again, can be the new Congress. One of them has to be protecting material conditions, building kinship networks, having free healthcare screenings, creating breakfast programs again, building co-ops and gardens, things like that. Because I'm telling you, food prices are going to skyrocket, jobs are going to leave, and more resources that we need to just have regular healthy lives are going to be gone. So we have to build this movement, and all this energy, these 10,000 people are talking to each other and saying, okay, now that we have this relationship, we take the infra-political anger and fervor that we go to these protests with, and we hold meetings and working, and we create working groups for specific things that we have to deal with in our communities. We have to look at what Huey Newton, we're going to talk about this later when we do the Black Panthers, this revolutionary intercommunalism, that we are all oppressed communities that have to take care of each other and survive and strengthen ourselves. And so we have to come up with an agenda. That's what we have to use this energy of these 10,000 peoples and actually create an agenda of survival.
Okay.
That's the big thing that we have to do. And then that will lead to us finding those candidates for that new Congress.
Oh, good point. Very good point, Gus. Yeah.
Well, I think people ought to look at this because, see, this is something that you can go out and knock on doors with and talk to people about. Because a lot of times when I think about this, I'm like, well, what am I going to say to people? What am I going to do? I mean, the Green Party maybe should have been doing a lot more of that.
yes.
But because if you look at their, if you look at their agenda, which is pretty much what is going to appeal to all these people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a progressive populist agenda.
And this, and one of the things that's interesting is that I take these ideas. This is an amazing book from this woman, this anthropologist named Carol Stack, who wrote this book, All Our Kin. And for people that don't know, it was the book used pseudonyms throughout it, but they found out after the book came out that she actually did it in Champaign.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, one of the biggest books ever to talk about kinship networks and survival units in Black communities. Because she actually went and lived in Champaign in the North End area and saw how they used it, because they had very little resources and materials, and built it up, and then they would door knock to find out, what is it that you need right now? You know, what's going on in the community? Like having these different things happen, pooling money together, resources, networks, etc. That has to be our focus now, is building our communities and strengthening them in so many ways. And like Bill said, it's a historical trend of African American communities. We've always done this, going back into the slave community.
You always had to organize.
And you had to, because there was no other way to survive, because we didn't have any money, food, or anything. So if we didn't pull our resources together, then people would starve to death, or they would be killed by vigilantes or police. So that was why.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Well, the Jewish people, and that's one of the reasons that a lot of non-Jews are suspicious of them.
And you had the same thing happen when the Italian immigrants came over as well. They have very big kinship networks as well.
Yeah, all the ethnic groups, the Irish, even the Germans early on, you know, the early years of the labor movement in this country, I should say post-Civil War labor movement.
Yeah, it's a... That just reminded me of a study I read about 20 years ago about social communication networks, and it was talking about how in Korean communities, immigrant communities, that the beauty shops were a place where you could reach a lot of people.
Beauty shop. Traditionally, it was always the churches and the taverns were labor organized. But barber shops and beauty shops,
social spaces as well. You know?
See, that's something that we've talked about before that took me a long time to realize, is that's how come we have such a difficult time organizing now, especially in workplaces, because I'm going to be starting a job in Danville Monday.
Oh, lucky you.
You know, I'm not going to the bar or the church or something there, and they're not going, I'm not going to a church anywhere, but, you know, I'm not hanging out in Danville talking to the guys about the revolution.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's huge. And that's the big question, is how do we organize, because late capital has dispersed jobs and labor, our relationships to the means of production in the way, like Bill said, it's difficult to organize, particularly and also with social spaces being taken away as well, because of, this, the new debt, from Lake Capitol and what it does.
And the corporate control of media and hence culture has over time, you know, this goes back even farther though than the more recent phenomena of it, has broken down these previous, you know, kinships networks.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, you have recent immigrants that still have them, but, you know, anything that's, you know, Irish, German, or even African American has been broken down and you know, people are alienated, you know.
Right. Exactly. That's the thing that we don't understand and we have to do more reading and studying about is how alienation has transformed from industrial capital to late capital. There's a lot about industrial alienation and what it does to the body, to the society, to your social relationships, but nobody has really looked at what alienation has done to in terms of late capital so we can understand how to build these kinship networks, how we can organize against this. Because I'm telling you, the biggest thing is what Bill was saying earlier, is that you have petty bourgeoisie leadership who want to focus everything on identity and don't want to focus on material, because many of the petty bourgeoisie have their material taken care of. They're fine.
Yeah.
They're not struggling.
Right.
And then you also don't have enough of this push to pull these resources together and to actually create an agenda of things, that actionable items that we have to do to survive and build our communities up, as they're going to be ravaged by what's happening with late capital and now a Trump federal system.
And as you said, Gus, from that, then you can get real candidates for real people.
And that's how you build.
Yeah,
and
this organization here, they say they do no politicians at all.
And no corporate money.
And that's what Alden Morris was talking about in his amazing book, Origins of the Civil Rights Movement. You don't have politicians or external people coming in and doing these things. You have local movement centers. When we're doing what Bill was saying, and you build and you organize, you find and you create leaders out of your local communities who will take leadership positions. And that's why rank and file has been getting screwed, because they've been letting external leaders come in instead of blossoming their own leadership. And that's what you have to have, an internal rebellion in the labor movement to bring that back.
Yes, Angela.
Yeah, and you know what, I was agreeing with Gus too, and you know, like, people even like Gus, me, you know what I'm saying, I'm a person, I know a lot of people, I need to get more educated than what I am. And, you know, I agree with Gus on that.
One of the most revolutionary acts I think one can do at this point in time for a first step is get to know your neighbor.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
That's simple.
Yes. Another trait of these white Trump voters were that they live in rural areas and are pretty much isolated from any people of color at all. I remember growing up, man, my parents – see, the thing, they were horribly bigoted and definitely racist, but they weren't, like, in the Klan, and they didn't have Confederate flags and stuff like that. It was just something that they didn't really talk about that much, because they weren't – the only times they saw black people is if we'd go shopping, you know, and there was the shoe shine stands. And then there was a black family that would come through the country every year and wash and wax your car.
There's a good article on Facebook, Bill, I should send you. It's about this guy. He's from Illinois, in fact. He grew up in a small town here in Illinois.
I read it.
You read it, okay. Where he talks about
the
urban-rural divide, the cultural divide. Like, he talks about, he goes, we had African-American people in our town. We knew them and got along with them. It wasn't them. It was that big, scary menace of the big cities and how your car would break down and you'd be pulled out of your car and killed. Where does that come from? I mean, you know what I'm saying? Obviously, that is a part of the ruling class's way of dividing and conquering.
Yeah, my dad, I remember one time he went to St. Louis and he got off on the wrong road. He goes, I bet I drove 2 miles without seeing a white person. And I said, man, you can drive 60 miles from Decatur to Champaign and not see a black person. Now, that is changing.
Yeah.
In fact, I was at the West End Saloon a few months ago, and there was an African-American man there, and he was wearing, like, this stock car, NASCAR jacket. Yeah. That some guy had just won a race, and he was, I mean... Hmm. You know, I used to know an African-American bricklayer from a small town. Yeah. I believe it was Fairbairn.
I guess you said in Atlanta there's a lot of African-American and Latino people that have been moving out of the city center of Atlanta because they can't afford it and moving into smaller towns around. Is that correct?
I mean, yeah, because, you know, the way Atlanta is set up is that it's this mega metropolitan area, because a bunch of the areas around it were incorporated around the mid-1970s.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these little counties that are not really part of the city. and they're suburban, and that's where a lot of the white people lived when the black majority came in the 1970s, because there were still jobs available, most of them service sector jobs, because Atlanta is a regional distribution center, and you know, because they didn't have much of an industrial base,
yeah, railroad hub,
and exactly.
You know, I was wondering if like all the gentrification that's going on, if our cities are going to turn out more like European cities, where their upper classes more or less have the city, but there's a ring of poor suburbs.
But that's the goal. And there's an amazing movie about that too, that really doesn't even look at the financial like rich people part of it, but the actual suburbs in Italy called Gomorrah. Ooh, I'm telling you.
Gomorrah.
You're talking about one of the greatest, wow. You're talking about one of the greatest working class movies I've ever seen, and how they basically have to, these are working class people that fell into the lumpen proletariat, and no matter how hard they try, they have to, they can't get out of the lumpen proletariat and join another class.
That's Trailer Park Boys, man.
Yeah. I'm telling you. Yeah.
Every season. Here's how we're gonna make it. You know?
You gotta,
back to jail.
That's the movie though, that if you really want to see like what's happening in other countries and how it happens here in relation to what Bill said, that you do have these very working class and sub working class areas outside the city limits now. And Bill is right that you're actually seeing financial centers becoming the new urban area now. When you go into Atlanta now, all you see are these ridiculously high skyscrapers and buildings, something you would never see about 10 to 15 years ago, and something that people dreamed about 20, 30 years ago. Yeah. But it's happening here, and it's happening in other majors, in Chicago right now.
Yeah.
A lot of that old infrastructure is starting to be torn down for these new high rises as well. Detroit.
How much is there enough low income housing in Champaign? Because I'm starting to see more and more people of color in Piatt County.
Yeah.
And see, like in Bement, you can buy a house easy for less than $50,000.
Yeah.
And one house that I lived in out in the country, it came up for sale last fall for $24,500. That's what they were asking.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break here, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the Rural Labor Hour on WRFU, Radio Free Urbana. We'll be right back.
It's Cesar Chavez. Maybe it was Darcy Day. Some will say Dr. King or Gandhi set them on their way. No matter who your mentors are, it's pretty plain to see. If you've been to jail for justice, you're in good company. Have you been to jail for justice? I want to shake your hand. Sitting in and lying down, always to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom? Or march that picket line. Have you been to jail for justice? Oh, you're a friend of mine. You law-abiding citizens, listen to this song. Laws were made by people, and people can be wrong. Once unions were against the law, but slavery was fine. Women were denied the vote and children worked for mine. The more you study history, the less you can deny it. A rotten law stays on the books till folks with guts defy it. Have you been to jail for justice? I want to shake your hand. Sitting in and lying down are ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom? Or march that picket line. Have you been to jail for justice? Oh, you're a friend of mine. Now the law's supposed to serve us, and so are the police. When that system fails, it's up to us to speak our peace. It takes eternal vigilance for justice to prevail. So get courage from your convictions. Let them haul you off to jail. Have you been to jail for justice? I want to shake your hand. Sitting in and lying down are ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Will you go to jail for justice? Have you been to jail for justice? Oh, you're a friend of mine. let's start with the story of Rodney King. Keep your eyes on the prize and hold on. I watched them beat him on TV, and Simi Valley set them free. Keep your eyes on the prize and hold on. Hold on.
Yes, this is No Time for Despair, as Ann Feeney sings there. The first song you heard from her was Have You Been to Jail for Justice? And the second one was, Rebuild America, Keep Hope Alive, even though I hate using that term now since Obama ruined it, I'm afraid to say, which is part of the reason why I think you had this big, the election that the results we got was because, Obama, as we were just talking and we were off air, is that Obama came in with huge support of the American people. He could have been not just a good president, but one of the greatest presidents of all time. Within a short time in office, we realized that he wasn't working for the people, he's working for corporate America.
The very first time, I'm telling you, when I first went, the 2 days after the election, when you start seeing his list of cabinet members,
yes,
when that came out, that was like the worst day of my life. And I thought to myself, what have I done? Because he picked the same neoliberals that Bill Clinton had used to totally just ravage the working class in this country.
Same Clinton's wife.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It picked everybody that Clinton had used. So at that point, it was that point on that I had absolutely no faith in him whatsoever. I mean, because when you put your list of cabinet members out, you're letting the world know this is who I'm with. So today, everyone, well, not today, but really this whole year, we've been celebrating low-key the 50th anniversary of the formation of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in October of 1966. Easily one of the most influential, misunderstood, and for lack of a better term, misanalyzed group ever. There's been so much talk about their cultural ramifications and what they did in terms of the black and the carrying the guns and stuff. That's the stuff that you hear about in the corporate media. That's what you hear about in films and things like that. But what we have to recognize is that regardless of some of the issues the Panthers had, that there was so much powerful ideology that not only the federal government stole from them, but things that African-American communities have historically and continue to do today that we can take in this moment of survival against the Trumps. So let's do a quick recap of what happened with the Panthers in 1966. They were founded in Oakland, California by Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, and we'll talk more about Huey later. The two met at Merritt College in Oakland, where they participated in black nationalist formations such as the Afro-American Association and the big one, another group that's rarely talked about, Revolutionary Action Movement, RAM, one of the most powerful groups at the time. Newton and Seale led the RAM-sponsored Soul Students Advisory Council, which organized a successful struggle to get black studies added to the curriculum. At the time, 1966, one of the biggest aspects of the Black Power movement was the creation of the black studies curriculum, and not just in grade schools, but also in colleges. So you had different departments creating black studies now as a form of not just, and people can think of it strictly as cultural, but it was a very political movement to really understand how self-determination works. You had some of the most amazing books come out that really got to the heart of understanding resistance and capital, and not just these petty bourgeoisie books. You had John Blasingame's Slave Community. You had Robert Allen's Black Awakening in Capitalist America, still the best book ever about how neo-internal colonialism works. You had so many different books, Slave Culture, and the list goes on. I don't want to take.
Yeah, and just for some historical context, the year 1966. This is a time period when the civil rights movement in the South was pretty much sort of winding down, right?
Yeah, and that's important to recognize, is that it's a transitional period, and that we don't want to conflate the two, the civil rights movement and black power movements, together, because they were not. They had separate goals, separate leaders, they had separate symbols, and they had separate movements and actions. And that's very important to recognize. Whereas in the civil rights movement was a liberal integrationist movement in terms of accommodation and putting black people more so in the system of America. Yeah.
It was basically a co-optation.
Yeah, that exactly. It was, the whole idea was that we should have fair share in working in America's system of capitalism. That was the gist of the civil rights movement. Whereas the black power movement recognized this, because most of the black power movement advocates were working class people, and recognized that there was no way that we could fit in this system, because there has to be a hierarchy that puts the dispossessed people at the very bottom. So it is
capitalism.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's capitalism. It is useless to do that. And as black people, we are at the bottom rung. So it's a big mistake to follow liberal integrationism. That's why black power was so important. And you had so many different strands of it. You had the black nationalist movement that did, you know, that believed in being part of the state. You had black capitalism. That was another strain. That was what Richard Nixon picked up on, he got a lot of black votes because of that. You also had the revolutionary Marxists, the ones who did not believe in capitalism and wanted to create a stateless society. And you also had the separatists, the black separatists, who wanted to keep a nation, but they wanted to be a separate nation just solely for black folk. So the black power movement was so complex, and there were so many different strands of it. So the question for Huey and Bobby was, what were they going to embrace? And they started reading a lot of Marx. They started reading a lot of Mao. They started reading so many different things, and they embraced the idea of revolutionary nationalism, or revolutionary socialism. So the Panthers' focus, and then the big thing that they did this on and how they started it, was Newton, after the Watts Rebellion in Los Angeles, this idea of surveilling the police became a big aspect of the community. So Newton and Seale took this idea, let's patrol the police so that our people can stop being beaten up. And that's how the Black Panther Party was first started, this idea of self-defense. Let's patrol the police, and let's train our community members on how to use martial arts, how to use guns, and how to alert their neighbors when the police are attacking and killing them.
And knowing the law, too, right?
And knowing the law, exactly. So they actually taught civil government and civil whatever in class. So they actually taught those classes in the community. So... And what they did was, this is interesting to recognize as well, because Hassan Jeffries wrote a great book that showed that they took a lot of these ideas that they were reading about, and they took them from groups like the Deacons of Defense in Alabama, who were actually using self-defense as a means to protect against what was going on with the Alabama voting rights campaign, where you had a lot of backlash, and white supremacists were lynching black people at that time for going to vote. And so the Deacons of Defense in Alabama, they were doing all this organizing against that. Huey had been in Alabama, and he had known a lot of Deacons of Defense. And so he took some of those ideas for that to California with them. So there was some going across the country in idea setting. That's important to recognize. In L.A., so you have patrols of the police were carried out after Watts. And there was one difference, though, between what Newton and Seale wanted. The Panthers wanted to arm themselves. So instead of just patrolling and watching them, we're patrolling them and we're carrying guns.
That's important. A typical patrol would involve three or four Panther members following police cars until officers pulled someone over. The Panthers, displaying their guns openly in accordance with the law, would jump out of their car and perform a cop watch, monitoring the actions so the police didn't use undue force. The Panthers carried around law books to let people know their rights and to read them when the cops went back in the car, and to show cops the law, the law if officers questioned their right to bear arms. The spark started a huge fire amongst the residents of the Bay Area, and they, and you started seeing other country, other communities adopting the same model. So this wasn't just in California; it spread across the country. And this, and you know, this was when Hoover was like, "We got a problem here."
The director of the FBI,
yeah, director J. Edgar Hoover. These brothers are bringing books and guns to police stops. So this is like, whoa, wait a minute. This is before the Panthers are fully, like, they have their full agenda set already. So this is when things are getting interesting. So the Panthers formed as the civil rights movement went into an impasse. So this is, and this is an important, interesting note. A lot of the civil rights middle class people were not, did not like this self-defense violence idea. You know, this idea of arming yourself and patrolling the police. The civil rights people, mostly ministers, were like, you know, we got our voting rights bill. We got our civil rights bill. We don't need to rock the boat to the point to where we're bringing more police presence in our neighborhoods that could lead to more violence. If you're bringing guns, you need to settle down. So that's that. So that, so you have that, that conflict between the civil rights groups and the black power groups at that time. That's very important to recognize. So in, on March 16, 1967, the Panther newspaper printed out the 10-point platform that proved that the Panthers were now going to be revolutionary socialists. And so they had rejected the idea of nationalism. They were going for statelessness, as most Marxists do. We want freedom. We want power to determine the destiny of our black community. Now, again, these are very basic, general parts to a 10-point plan. But what's important about them is that they are objectives of what they plan to do. Whereas in most people today are creating demands that are just like, hey, we just want these demands, da 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 da. They are actually saying we are going to do these things and this is how we're going to implement them. We want full employment for our people. We want an end to the robbery by white men and capitalists of the black communities. We want decent housing fit for shelter for human beings. We want all black men to be exempt from military service. We want all, we want an immediate end to police brutality and murder. We want all black people when brought to trial to be tried in the court by a jury of their peer groups. We want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace. So you had a 10-point objective plan of the things that we are going to tackle locally in each chapter that is going to build throughout the nation and other areas as well. That's so important to recognize, and that's what we need to get back to today, is we have to have a 10-point plan of how to build our community, strengthen it, and survive.
But as you said, it wasn't just this nice-sounding manifesto they put out. They actually put this in practice in their community. How?
Exactly. So from the first point, the platform makes connections between the call for freedom and the practical implications of this demand in northern cities, where black folks were already free on paper but continued to suffer oppression in practice. The Panthers declared that freedom must be connected to having, and this is big, self-determination, meaning I have the power to determine my life. And under capitalism, you cannot determine your life, because when you sign that contract, your time and body belongs to the employer. Therefore, capitalism and freedom do not make sense. And that was a basic argument of the revolutionary socialists, of, and also the anarchists as well. So, meanwhile, so in January 1967, after police in Richmond murdered an unarmed black man, Denzel Dole, the Panthers were called in by residents. The group led an armed march to the police station to demand the details about the case. The Panthers put enough pressure on the district attorney that he prosecuted the cop, which did not happen at that time. Trust me, that's the research I look at. The case ended in acquittal, but the Panthers showed that they could actually get things done. So, of course, you take that first action, you build on it. So responding to the Panthers' armed protest, the California legislature took up a bill to limit the carrying of loaded guns in public, and it was the start of the modern gun control movement.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize that. Yes. A lot of people think that gun control was just something one day that Obama came in and was like, oh, my God, I heard him say he's going to take our guns, so we're going to start this gun movement. And then, no, it started back when they saw black folks carrying guns protect their neighborhoods.
Well, wasn't there like earlier sort of Jim Crow gun laws in the South? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, but this is made. We're talking about out in California,
right? I remember
that. Yeah, but yeah, you're right. They already had gun control measures in the South already. But this big gun movement that started with going to get the NRA to do all this stuff, it started back in California when the Panthers started carrying guns.
You know what, Gus? Another point about the Panthers is that they would pick that one guy. Remember, they chose Kadeem Hardison in that movie to give them information about what the Panthers were doing.
All the police informants? Okay.
Yeah, I was going to get to that, but yeah, that's an important thing.
And the movie you're talking about is Mario Van Peebles' film Panthers, I think. Mm-hmm.
So outside of patrolling the police, Dave mentioned earlier when I was talking about these other things of bread, land, food, etc., and what we do. And the Panthers were one of the first groups to really embrace this serious idea of struggle, meaning that we're going to support our community and build these kinship networks. So in these poor black neighborhoods, the organizational base was serving the community. So operating in areas where social services were inaccessible and non-existent, the Panthers established their famous free breakfast program for children, along with, because they only people always talk about just the free breakfast program, but they also had a health clinic, they had clothing distribution, they had liberation schools that were set up in every community that emphasized black history. They had an escort and bus service for the elderly, and free plumbing and maintenance services.
Wow, I wasn't aware about the maintenance part.
And this is important because, again, this is something that I saw happen in Atlanta in a couple instances in my research. We could do this. We can have communities where we take people who are retired and use their skills to help parts of the community so that we don't have to pay for certain things. And that way we can pool money and resources. That's what they did. They had daycare centers because, of course, you know, child care is very expensive. They would create a partnership with church preachers so that the church can be used as a daycare center for free. So all these different things that would ease the material strengths in the community, the Panthers did that, and they did it for a long time.
And this is what J. Edgar Hoover found the most threatening. He found that more threatening than them carrying the gun.
This is when what Angela said a minute ago, that you started seeing increased infiltration and surveillance of the Panthers when they created all of these community service programs, and much of those programs were taken over by the federal government, they were co-opted by the federal government into what we have today, the free breakfast program and other social service programs. So, but in other words, what people don't, and this is something I don't talk much about because I'm still reading my Mao, but when you look at what Maoism, what the ideology, not necessarily the actual rule itself, because we can get into that later, but the actual ideology of Maoism, with this vision of revolutionary cadre who serve the people first, that's the biggest thing, and that's what you would always hear H. Rap Brown talk about when he spoke. Chairman Mao says this. Chairman Mao wrote this. Chairman Mao said this. That's important because the big thing is about the first message, no matter what we do, is serve the people. Serve the people. Serve the people. That was their biggest thing. But unfortunately, the Panthers continue to be just all the thing they talk about are the guns and the black clothing. That you don't ever hear about the serving the people, which was their number one focus.
I mean, they started a whole fashion trend with their black jackets and their black
important
berets.
To recognize
it's by, cultural, political, economic.
But when you do this, when you focus solely on their dress, and the carrying of the guns, you make it more cultural, and you take away that political aspect. And when you do that, you're depoliticizing a movement and making it solely into identity politics.
And that's
dangerous.
But they all, whatever level you're working on, you've always got all these things always interact. The political, the economic, the cultural.
I agree. But when you
overemphasize that, the superficial aspects of it,
but there's a reason behind that, though. You have the anti-radicals and the anti-black forces from COINTELPRO and the FBI, which I'm about to talk about, that purposely did that. Mm-hmm. Like, we want to emphasize the cultural so that we can show that there's a cultural distinction between black and white workers so that we can understand that they are not as good as us. That's important to recognize.
Label, Gus. They give you labels, so that puts you in what category, in different categories so that they know how to go about doing things. And if you have too much knowledge, have you heard the saying knowledge is power? You talking too much and you talking good, somebody gonna try to knock you out the way.
Well, it's just, and it's also capitalism dividing workers, etc. So
The explosive growth of the Panthers began with the Free Huey campaign at the end of 1967. In the first half of the next year, the organization established 12 new chapters and more than 1,000 people joined. By early 1969, the Panthers had as many as 5,000 members, but the violent repression that landed Newton behind bars continued to take a toll. You had local police routinely raiding Panther offices, supposedly searching for illegal weapons, and because they came in shooting, many one-sided battles ensued. In the two-year span, and this is important, listeners, this is huge, because a lot of people like to put forth this ridiculous argument that the Panthers imploded, meaning that most of the reason that they fell apart was internal issues, which is completely false. In the two-year span of 1968 to 1969, more than 35 Panthers were killed, and at least twice as many were wounded by police. Again, in the two-year span of 68 to 69, more than 35 Panthers were killed and at least twice as many were wounded by police. 2 days after the assassination of King in 68, police opened fire unprovoked in the confrontation with Panthers in Oakland. Cleaver was wounded, and Bobby Hutton, Newton and Seale's first recruit back in 1966, was killed. Cleaver spent 2 months in prison because of that issue. The COINTELPRO program launched in the 1950s to, quote, disrupt and destabilize, cripple, destroy, and otherwise neutralize all radical organizations in the United States, targeted the Panthers as one of the main groups. The targeting of Panthers, and listen to this, listeners, because again, we have to dispel this ridiculous myth that the Panthers imploded internally. That was the only reason they fell apart. The targeting of Panthers led to 348 felony arrests in 1 year.
Whoa.
1969, 348 felony arrests of Panthers in 1 year. That's targeting. FBI and local police coordinated efforts often conducted joint raids or just plain drive-by shootings on Panther headquarters.
The police did drive-by shootings.
Yes, the police did drive-by shootings. And this is recorded everywhere.
Okay, we're going to pick this topic up here in just a moment. We do have now our caller calling in. So, and it should be, I believe, John Ryman from the West Coast. Hello, WRFU, you're on the air.
Good morning. This is John calling.
Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm doing okay, as well as can be expected.
Okay, considering the election outcome.
Yeah, right. Although, there is a silver lining in there, you know. I mean, it is just so easy to get into discussions with people now. You know, just neighbors, people that, you know, I've never seen before in my community. The guys picking up the garbage, security guard at the local supermarket. Just everybody wants to talk.
Well, that's good. I mean, that's, we were trying to talk about some of the silver linings here. About this election, and so I'm glad to hear that this is kind of maybe sort of broken the ice on striking conversations up with other working people you don't know.
Yeah.
And when you really look at it, I was reading an article in today's Washington Post about Trump's plans, and he's really backing off on a lot of things in both foreign policy and domestic. Even they were talking with one advisor of his who was close to him about building the wall, and the advisor said, well, he's still going to do that, but not right away. So I mean, in reality, when you start listening to it and watching what's going on, the policies that he's going to implement are not that radically different from Hillary Clinton if she had won.
Exactly, because she's, and Dave mentioned this earlier in the program, that he's already bringing in some of those neoliberals and bankers and stuff that were riding with her. Yeah,
right. And I mean, one big difference is, you know, that his campaign has really whipped up the racist far-right terrorist groups. But they would have been whipped up if he had won or not.
Yeah, and that's the argument I made as well. Yeah.
So, I mean, and if Clinton had won, I think everybody would have breathed a sigh of relief, like at least we defeated Trump.
And then basically things would have been back to where people wouldn't be doing much or, you know, wanting to do that much.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, I'm not saying it. Let's put it this way. No matter who had won, it would have been a defeat for the working class.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
And a defeat for especially oppressed groups, for women, people of color, immigrants, and so on.
Yeah.
And even as far as deportations, well, we'll see what he does about that. But let's not forget that there was more people deported under Obama than there was under Bush.
Yes.
Yeah.
So even that, I mean, nobody's safe, you know. So as I say, you know, the big difference, of course, is what he stirred up. And we can't just ignore that or pretend that it's just, you know, just some little thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, John, that rally out in Oakland that gathered about 7,000 people, who organized that? Was it a coalition of groups? Or?
As far as I know, well, all I saw on Facebook, I saw a notice on Facebook about it that was put up by Socialist Alternative.
Okay.
And they were one of the organizers. There's another group, I think, that was involved in organizing, but certainly was prominent at the rally. It's a group, Anti-Police Terror Project.
Okay.
But I think it was just like halfway spontaneous, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
Like, Oscar Grant Plaza is the place to go whenever there's like something that you want to protest.
Yeah.
Gus was talking earlier about the various, I mean, it wasn't just in Oakland, it was other places around the country, Chicago, New York, mm-hmm. and everything. And I guess, Gus, maybe you could share your kind of thoughts about what you were saying earlier about all these people coming out in these protests about what you think needs to happen as opposed to,
Exactly. Like, the thing I was saying in terms of building a social movement or building local movements.
Can I just interrupt you? I can't quite hear you, Gus.
Okay, I'm turning the mic up. Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, a little bit better, yeah.
Okay.
So early in the show, we were talking about the different demonstrations that were happening. And the biggest thing I wanted to emphasize is that we don't want this to just solely be an infra-political anger, this fervor of just, let's just protest and then we'll just have to deal with it later. Take the momentum of these thousands and thousands of people and build this into an objective of survival and protection and community building and strengthening. You know, this is the perfect time to take this and say, okay, so what type of actionable items can we do now that we have this anger and this fervor? So that, and that's the first step of building a local social movement. So you have these items, particularly when you see that the resources are going to be usurped from working class communities. So what can we do to stave off that? What can we do in terms of dealing with state sponsored and vigilante terrorist acts against African Americans and brown people? You know, in terms of self-defense violence, or self-defense movements and communities. So in other words, what I'm saying is that we don't want this to just be a static protest time period of about 2 weeks and then it just goes off and then we just deal with Trump. We got to take this anger and this fervor and we got to use it to build kinship networks and communal organizations at the grassroots level and use that to build these local movement centers up so that we can start picking from the working class, the rank and file, I like to call it, to be our next leaders instead of having to deal with leaders given to us by these partisan groups. And I think that's really the step that we can take at this point in regards to these protests. You know, like I said, I'm a big protest person. I believe that you should have those. But the problem is that a lot of these national groups, well, a lot of them are petty bourgeoisie, but the other issue is that they take these protests and they just use them as symbolic and not necessarily action.
Like they're kind of like an end of in and of themselves.
Exactly. And that's the biggest fallacy that could happen in trying to build a social movement, because by that point, people get disillusioned.
That exact same thing myself, because one thing that the Occupy movement showed was, and their whole unspoken strategy was, just get out there in the street and protest. Protest, protest, protest. And you can't live on that alone, you
exactly.
know? And so...
Basically, you're saying without any kind of direction or purpose other than just a protest.
Right, and mm-hmm. without actually organizing, sinking roots. Well, there's two things. One thing that I think we have to say is we have to beware of the danger of the liberals.
Yeah.
First and foremost, people like Robert Reich and Bernie Sanders, of them sucking this movement dry. Because
yeah.
Bernie Sanders now, and it was clear all along this was his intent, he's now trying to put all the resources into reforming the Democratic Party.
You're right.
And
yep.
especially the Democratic National Committee. And the rest of them, Robert Reich and all of them, that's what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have their local representatives in every movement trying to head things in that direction. And also the union leaders will be doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So we have to be aware of that. And as far as just protest, I was thinking about, like something I was thinking about, I think what you were talking about earlier, I think it was you, Gus, was talking about the Black Panther Party mm-hmm. and their community controls.
Mm-hmm. Now, you lived out in Oakland, didn't you, John, when the Black Panthers were in their heyday?
Yeah, somewhat. I moved out here in 1969.
Okay.
So, you know, I was thinking, like, why can't we, especially people who live or have connections in communities where there's diversity and also in especially including large immigrant communities and so on, why can't we just call for a public meeting?
Exactly.
Especially since I'm seeing so many people who are wanting to talk about these things. Just if there's a little park near you or someplace like that,
yep.
just say, come and just, what does this mean? What does President Trump mean? And how can we organize against it? And,
yeah.
you know, come to a meeting at such and such a place. And let's talk and see if we can't start building up neighborhood defense committees.
Exactly.
And the other thing that I was thinking, it might be possible, maybe you could coordinate that with teachers in your local grade school. Like there's a school just a couple blocks from me, and I'm thinking about going up there, seeing if I can find the union rep there or some other teachers who are a little bit more activists and seeing if they would be interested in helping to organize that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that could be the next step. Yeah, we have to have the protest. I think there's going to be a huge protest when Trump is inaugurated on January 20th.
Yeah, it's going to be, yeah.
But we have to actually start organizing, you know?
Yeah. Now, you know, in particular with the union movement, we were talking earlier about, you know, I know, you know, you have your different, you don't like Bernie Sanders a whole lot, but the thing was is that the union leadership, the national union leadership, with the exception of the UE, the CWA, the postal workers, and the nurses, National Nurses Union, all of them immediately jumped on, you know, board with Hillary Clinton's campaign, despite never taking a poll of their members, and even, you know, a lot of locals, even in the billing trades, basically defied the national and made their own endorsements of Bernie Sanders. And, I mean, this was just such an absorption of democracy. You know, so I think, you know, one of the people to blame or one of the things to blame for this outcome of getting Trump elected is the national union leadership. What do you think of that, John?
Well, just in terms of the election, whole election process as a whole, you know, there was an absolute deafening silence in the whole election process, and that was this a deafening silence of the voice of the working class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What else is new?
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Although, you know, I was talking with some of the young people at that rally the other night, and nobody even thought about that. Nobody even thought about the absence of the unions, and we've seen that mm-hmm. all the protests, for instance, about the police murdering different people and stuff like that, the unions are totally absent, and they're so absent that nobody thinks about it. And as I've repeated probably 100 times, when I was in Ferguson, right after Michael Brown was assassinated, I was talking to one guy who was a member of the UAW, the United Auto Workers, who told me that his local union leaders had told him, this is not our battle.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And the reason is that they are just in bed with the Democratic Party.
Now, wasn't
pure and simple unionism, too.
Yeah. Even in a case when a union member is killed, like, wasn't Oscar Grant a member of a union?
No, he was working at a store that the union was trying to organize.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it doesn't matter if it's a union member or not. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. But even in the case where it'd be their own member, they probably wouldn't do anything.
Well, I mean, if you're organizing, don't you think it would help if you really stood up to something like that, even if they're
But that's the same thing
to help you organize the place.
That's the same thing.
Common sense.
That's the same thing that happened in Atlanta.
Organized workers, yes. But the point is, they're not. They're trying to organize the employees and also act as the junior partners
exactly.
of the Democratic Party leadership.
What were you saying about Atlanta, Gus?
But that's what John is saying is exactly what happened. And the research I'm doing now for my dissertation on working class resistance in Atlanta is you had these union leaders coming when they were issuing these complaints that African Americans were getting fired and not getting having severe pay cuts, et cetera. I mean, a whole list of things. The union leadership would tell them this is not our fight.
Oh,
seriously, they would tell them. So you had Wildcat
I'll give you
stuff
an
starting.
How this approach of theirs affects the members every day on the job. I remember quite a few years ago talking with a fellow carpenter who was telling me, this is a black guy, who was telling me that he was on the job and the foreman told him, okay, everybody take a break except for you, I forget his name, you have to keep on working. And everybody else was white. And the thing is, standing right there next at the time, almost next to him, was our senior business agent, who himself was a black guy. And
really?
The business agent just looked at him and smiled and shrugged his shoulders.
Oh, yep.
They are so in bed with the employers that they can't fight it.
And that's because, John, isn't it because all they care about is the dues money flow to continue their salaries and benefits and jobs, the union staffers?
Their strategy to keep the dues money coming in is to keep the employers happy.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it'll be interesting to see what happens. One of the things that Trump is talking about is infrastructure.
Yes.
And building infrastructure. And I would be quite surprised if he does not open up those projects to non-union contractors.
Yep, exactly.
And even try to get rid of the federal prevailing wage laws.
Yep.
Right, exactly. And it'll also be interesting to see if they actually do move to build a wall. I mean, the building trades were in favor of the pipeline.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it'll be interesting to see what they say about building a wall.
Laborers love it.
Yeah.
Will that be jobs also? You know, it just reminds me of that conversation that I had years ago with a business agent where I said if they were going to build a prison to put all union members in, you guys would be in favor of it as long as it was built union. And he thought for a couple seconds and then said no. But the key is he had to think for a couple seconds first.
Well, you know what Gould said? He could hire half the working class to kill the other half.
Well, you can hire the union officials to imprison the rest of the working class. You can certainly do that.
Yeah.
If you're going to get paid enough. So, mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's the other thing to get back to the subject of Trump is, I mean, the problem is, you know, that Clinton was so totally unattractive to workers,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's because of the role of the union leadership, that there's nobody any better. And I know that Bernie Sanders had a more attractive countenance and everything. The Washington Post, incidentally, recently explained it, you know, that he had this nice grandfatherly appeal. But he himself, what's he saying now? He's saying he's going to try to work with Trump.
No kidding.
Yeah, he did. He put the statement out this morning.
Unbelievable. Now that unbelievable.
Yeah. So of course he quotes it in nice words insofar as he helps the working class. Well, I mean that's like saying insofar as Hitler. I mean I know Trump isn't a fascist quite, but it's like saying, well, insofar as Hitler tries to help Jewish people, we'll try to work with him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and we should, some of us saw it all along. This is what the Democratic Party is, including its liberal wing. And we can never, ever, ever trust them or support them.
Okay, John, well, listen, I really appreciate you calling in and sharing your views and everything. I think this is, we're kind of all sort of thinking on the same parallel track here, it seems like. So we'll definitely have to keep in touch and kind of fine-tune this as we go along.
Again, I'd like to put in a little,
yes,
a little plug for my blog, OaklandSocialist.com, and organize in your union, organize in your workplace, organize in your community. One or two people can do it, can start the ball rolling.
Great, great blog, by the way, too. I've been reading it recently, and like I said, we love when you call into the show, John, so thank you again.
Yeah, thanks again, John. Okay, take care. Okay, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WRFU, and we're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. Poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bone. A man that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older, deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, as I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, the sun didn't shine. I picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. Loaded 16 tons, a number 9 coal. And the store boss said, well, bless my soul. 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, as I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain.
Okay, that was Tom Morello in the version of 16 Tons, and you're listening to the World Labor Hour on WRFU 104.5 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WRFU.net, Radio Free Urbana, community radio by and for the people. Some quick public service announcements here. Today, the Standing Rock Benefit at the Independent Media Center from starting at 1 o'clock until 10 p.m. will host a fundraiser for water protectors in Standing Rock, North Dakota. And you can turn out to that to help the effort there, and there'll be lots of great bands for that and everything, and I'll let you know too that Governor Rauner is refusing to negotiate with state employees, and said he's asking the Illinois Labor Relations Board, which he appoints, to allow him to dictate all the terms of working lives. The ILRB is expected to issue its ruling on November 15th. Whatever the board says, the basic fact remains, Illinois Governor Rauner should negotiate, not dictate. So on this Thursday, coming Thursday, November 17th, state workers at work sites across Illinois will stand up and speak out, same with one voice, that we deserve a fair contract. And here in the Champaign-Urbana area, that'll be on November 17th at the state regional office, which is 2125 South 1st Street in Champaign. That starts at 12:15 till 12:45. And the UIC faculty union president to speak on the power of unions in higher education, Professor Janet Smith, will speak in Urbana on November 14th. That's coming up this Monday. Campus Faculty Association, the sponsor of this, which represents faculty at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus, is hosting a talk, and that's Monday, November 14th at 5 p.m. at the Chenny Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon. And also, to tune in to the World Labor Hour and the Union Edge at, after the World Labor Hour and Union Edge at 2 p.m. for another sports show, a radical look at the world of sports with host fellow worker Neil Parthen here on WRFU Radio Free Urbana, and also on WRFU this Sunday and every Sunday from 6 to 8. Tune in for the People's History Hour with Grant and Neil, and also on Sundays from 4 to 5 p.m. is Labor's Worldview TV at Comcast Channel 6 and live at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. This Sunday will be the history of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. Ooh. And lastly, this coming Thursday, November 17th, tune in at 7 p.m. to Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6, for the annual showing of the Nigel Turner documentary, The Men Who Killed Kennedy. So, okay.
Okay. Oh, by the way, folks, yes, don't forget about our friends at Chiampa Weed 420 Radio.
Yes.
Anthony and Joe, they do a live show on Monday nights from, I believe it's 7 Central Time, 8 Eastern Time, and just do a search for Chiampa. That's because Joe is in Chicago and Anthony is in Tampa, Florida, but they sound like they're in the same room. And I'd also like to apologize to the listeners for the poor quality of the telephone. We're hoping to get that fixed here real soon.
Okay, so we're quickly running out of time, and I think
also radioforall.net, folks. Go to Radio for All. That's Radio Digit for All.net, and you can find tons of great shows to listen to.
Okay, so let's pick up, Gus, where you left off with the 50th anniversary of the Black Panther party.
When I was talking, the last thing I talked about was that COINTELPRO had been launched to infiltrate the Black Panthers, and the one that they had two main tactics that COINTELPRO used. The first one was to use a lot of trumped up charges to put a lot of the Panthers in prisons and have them arrested for felony arrest. The second one that we'd mentioned earlier was having police agents infiltrate the group and then frame the organization's leaders and provoke confrontations, so create an internal rebellion, internal conflict. The FBI had also forged letters to try to sow hostility, so they would create letters that Huey had sent to Bobby Seale and try to create tension that way. So they would create these false letters and send them to each other's mailbox.
Kind of like what they did to the Dr. Martin Luther King, sending a letter to his wife,
Same thing. One operation tried to encourage David Hilliard, a prominent member of the group, to kill Huey Newton. So all the while, the death toll continued to rise. By January 1969, two Panther leaders in L.A. were murdered by members of a culturalist nationalist organization who are now believed to be FBI infiltrators. And I can do a whole show on that particular situation, but I don't want us to run out of time, but I've actually done research on that. And
is that the incident that drove David Horowitz to become a conservative?
I think it was.
Because he was involved with the Black Panthers, and then somebody got murdered.
They had a rivalry group on the campus of University. I don't want to say the wrong college, but it was probably the
University of California somewhere.
Yeah, but they had a violent confrontation because of the rivalry, and
And by this time in 69, chapters, the Black Panther Party chapters have spread all over the country.
Over the country now. You have tens of thousands.
Had one here in Champaign-Urbana, by the way.
Yeah. So everything was happening, but then again, you had these murders happening. Of course, the big famous one was the murder of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in Chicago while they were sleeping. And those pictures are online if you do want to see them, of the raid where they just basically just sprayed the place with bullets.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I want to compare this to the Bundys. Occupation. You had people there for over 40 days. Constantly broadcasting to the rest of the world that they were ready to die and all of this stuff, and they had guns and were brandishing, and it was just an insane thing. And they walk, don't want all occupier people, like if the GEO occupies the administration, I don't want them to go to jail, but the GEO is not going to be armed and constantly threatening and talking about killing people and being killed.
And that's important to recognize, because nobody ever stood trial for those killings, and we do find out that the infiltrator of the Panthers gave the full bedroom layout of Fred Hampton's place, and only I think he received $2 for it. But like we could do a whole nother
minimum wage was like $1.
Yeah, it was about $10 in today's money.
We can do a whole show on infiltrators alone. Yeah. But 69 was also the point in which you saw a new Panther Party emerge, because you had a reorientation that focused more so on political education, and you also had a changing of you had more women members joining, and then you had Kathleen Cleaver becoming the most prominent spokesperson and really changing the direction of the Panther Party. So a lot more survival programs were created when the women came in and became central focus members of the Panther Party. So party leaders from California traveled regularly to branches, and leaders of new chapters were expected to come to Oakland for 6 weeks of training. And then this is something big that Hilliard wrote about in his autobiography that many people don't talk about. Synonymous with our invincibility, and its publication is one of our top priorities. No more once every 2 weeks or 3 week issues in regards to the newspaper like we used to publish with Eldridge. Now the paper will appear like clockwork every Thursday, our lifeline to the chapters and community and the visible sign of our defiance of the pigs. End quote. And by that point, pigs not only meant cops, but capitalists as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was whenever you heard them give speeches, the capitalist pigs. So again, this is a new type of party now that was more so acting like we talked about what Huey P. Newton argued was revolutionary intercommunalism, that you have these different communities that are being organized in different places. And like you said, Dave, after you organize, then you start connecting across the country, then across the globe, and trying to build those networks up that way. And that's really the basis for how to build a social movement that mm-hmm. we really haven't looked at from this instance since the end of the Panthers.
Because there was after the Black Panthers organized in the black community all over the country, then they branched out. There was Brown Panthers of the Latino community.
Definitely. You had Brown Panthers. You had White Panthers.
Detroit. John Sinclair and the MC5.
Yeah.
Because remember, they were revolutionary socialists. They believed that there could be a working class coalition across race that could organize against capital and create a stateless society. So, yeah, they started branching out. And like Bill said, the White Panthers in Detroit were a very prominent group for a
period. In Chicago, under the leadership of Fred Hampton in the film Revolution 2, they had one of their Panther members that actually there's a poor white southern Appalachian community in Chicago that lived in the uptown area. It's kind of up on the north side. Actually reached out to the Panthers and wanted help in organizing their community. And the Panthers actually sent one of their delegates there. And there's actually film footage of this where he's talking to them. And they had all the same concerns. Basically, horrible housing, police harassment and brutality, horrible jobs and other things. And, this was amazing considering this was a group of poor, not just poor white people, but poor people from the South, which, all that baggage, supposedly. You know?
Dave, I actually am real close to somebody who was sort of in that situation.
Yeah, at that
time. And it was African Americans and these Appalachian whites versus Puerto Ricans.
So there was a rift eventually.
Oh, yeah.
The Puerto Ricans were the people, they were moving in and encroaching on the African Americans and the Appalachians.
Mm-hmm.
And other groups they reached out to were also bike gangs.
Oh, yeah.
To learn. And
yeah,
they had,
yeah.
And the Appalachians had gangs.
But so, yeah, that's really something that we have to recognize in that when you get into a lot of this branching out and these, you're gonna run into these issues. They're gonna come across, especially when the Panthers were starting to lose their funding because they were being financed by a lot of celebrities that sometimes who had leftist ties.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, you know, with the Cold War backlash, you had a lot of famous celebrities who were blacklisted, etc. But a lot of those celebrities would also fund the Panthers and give them money. Some of that money started running dry,
probably because of all the court cases.
Oh yeah, that was the big, and that was one of the way the COINTELPRO hurt the Panthers was that they were literally going broke paying out all the court cases and lawyer fees. So they actually would send people out to different areas to help them organize their communities and deal with like creating free breakfast programs for them, creating daycare centers, etc. That was their way of trying to recoup some type of funding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you know the back then communities would pool their money together to bring somebody in to actually help them build, to actually organize their community. Something that we talked about on this show for quite some time now. You got to pay for resources. You got to pay to get staff to come out and, you know, and organize or get these kids who have organizing abilities during the summertime and train them, you know?
That's one of the big things. I read a study that was, I believe it was written in the 1980s, talking about that's one reason why unions don't organize, mm-hmm. because they don't bank the money back in dues.
Well, why they'll basically leave a certain group of workers high and dry because they've decided that they won't get their money back in the dues. That's... Talk about business unionism. I mean, that's just a horrible model.
So one of the interesting things about what the Panthers were doing in terms of working class politics is that, and this is rarely talked about, is that they were, you know, their whole thing was about, you had one segment of the Panthers who believed in organized the lumpen, the D-class group, the ones who had been expelled from the working class, who make their money off predatory practices, illegal capitalism, etc. That's mm-hmm. what Marx talks about. But you had another segment that believed in the working class. So you did have some ideological fissure happening mm-hmm. within the Panthers themselves. But what they did was, they said, you know what, let's just go ahead and organize any dispossessed workers that we can find at the time. So they went in Detroit specifically, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers were put into the spotlight in terms of how to organize black workers who have been who have been thrown out of unionism and working class. For those that don't know, the League of Black Revolutionary Black Workers were a group of African American auto workers who chose to create their own union when they felt racism from the major national unions in Detroit, the UAW, etc. So the league formed as an extension of the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, and that's important. An organization of black auto workers at the Chrysler plant in Detroit that confronted the tyranny of auto bosses and the racism of the bureaucratic UAW. So the working class focus of the league influenced the formation of the Black Panther Caucus at the Giant General Motors factory in Fremont, California. And this is important because with Panthers organizing around workplace issues a short distance from party headquarters, the Black Panther newspaper started carrying more regular coverages of labor struggles. And this is the stuff you never hear anybody talk about with the Panthers.
I've never heard that.
No, this is very important. Yeah. And there's some great books from the League of Black Revolutionary Workers. There's one really good book about the history of that group that has a full chapter about the Panthers organizing and how they actually had issues dedicated solely to labor struggles. And this comes with them reading more and understanding the plight of working class struggles. Very important. In April 1969, John Watson of the Revolutionary Black Workers came to Oakland to participate with Panther leaders in the conference that the Panther newspaper hoped would be a historic breakthrough of a black community worker alliance. So what you saw happening in that 69 period was not just more political education, but you saw a transformation of not just organizing community, but organizing workers in the community. So addressing not only material conditions, but also labor struggle conditions. And that's something that we never talk about with in terms of the Panthers that needs to be, you know, the myth needs to be dispelled about them, that they were very much so involved in worker struggle.
Yeah. Bill, didn't you have one of the members of the Dodge on the show once years before I came on the program?
No, I don't think we ever did. We may have played something back that was about it from probably the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. By the way, that's another organization that exists.
Okay.
The League of Revolutionaries for a New America. They were primarily based in Chicago several years ago. Then they kind of fell apart, and now there's people in Detroit that are really organizing that.
So let me just go ahead and close this out in the last minute. By 1972 is when all the COINTELPRO and the infiltration and stuff, the money drying up, led to an organizational crisis. I mean, there was so much state repression by that point that there really was nobody really knew what the leadership structure was of the Panthers by 72. Eldridge Cleaver had been exiled. Bobby Seale tried to go into electoral politics in a very disastrous way. Huey Newton continued to have issues, and then, you know, and then drugs and stuff came in. And then, like I said, the organizations just really fell apart because there was so much money being bled into these the court cases, mm-hmm. and just that they weren't able to maintain their infrastructure. And then you had so many political prisoners. You had George Jackson executed in prison, who was a major person. You had H. Rap Brown put in prison, who was the big vocal spokesperson for the Panthers. So again, you had instead of this idea of just internal just combustion, it was really so much repression and forces that led to this kind of dissolving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And after the Panthers, I'm sorry, go ahead, Angela.
I wanted to say though, I believe that it really all came down when they put all the drugs into the neighborhood. And, you know, that was one of the things that Kadeem at the end was trying to, you know, they were trying for that not to happen. But all those drugs being put in the neighborhood, they know the people were going through a lot. So, okay, let's see them get high and kill themselves, you know.
Do you know the connection here? Because I've heard this before. I mean, you think about 72, that was the year the film Superfly came out. And this was like glorification of, basically selling.
It was also why the CIA was doing a bunch of stuff in the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia. Asia. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and later on it would be cocaine because of Central America.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was part.
And now it's heroin again.
That was a small part of it. That wasn't a very major contributing factor because remember the crack epidemic doesn't start until 84.
Yeah.
And that's when the CIA and Reagan and them were flooding drugs into the streets, et cetera. But in the 70s, remember that period I just mentioned, what was 72? One of the worst recessions.
Yes.
That was really a depression in American history. So that was also one of the biggest moments of deindustrialization and the removal of working